Hi, Antonio. Welcome back.
Hey, everybody. Happy to be back. It's been a while.
I never tried to pronounce your last name. Is it Goncalves?
Yes.
No, but not perfect. Say it.
Okay. There's the real name, the Portuguese name, Gonçalves.
Gonçalves?
Only Portuguese people can say that.
So, like me, because I was once, I delivered a Java course in, where was it? In Lisbon.
Oh, nice.
And it was, so then I can pronounce it, of course, Goncalves.
So, Gonçalves.
Gonçalves.
Yeah. With a S and a Sh at the end.
Sh. But Gonçalves.
But because people can't say that, we say Goncalves.
Goncalves. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Antonio is fine.
Mm-hmm. So we also had a listener. I don't want to tell the name, but it was Daniel, and he complained that I never introduced the guest by last name. So from time to time I do, and now he knows who you are. You know. So this is one of the two listeners we have, and one is unhappy. So but as I see, your mood is better because last time, as I remember, you almost cried because your toe was dry. There was dry skin on your toe a little bit, and you couldn't find a cream, you know, to make it beautiful again, right?
Yeah, no, because the nail, I lost a nail on the toe. That was so painful. But now, here I am with all my toes. Sorry?
All nails? 20 nails?
One on the foot, and it's enough. The big toe, you know, big nail.
But the nail is back or no?
Oh, yeah, but it took 9 months.
Yeah, but now this nail of one toe is better than the others, I guess, because it's completely new. No?
Yeah, totally shiny, beautiful.
Mm-hmm. So what if we meet, if you are in DevOps, for instance, I expect that you will come in sandals, you know, to show me the nails.
I should do that.
With rainbow colors, you know, this will be also cool on the nails. Or at least, you know, some microsystems colors. We don't have to be too extreme. And what also confuses me, your shirt, because you have lots of math formulas. So I try, you know, not to solve the formula when I speak with you. But is it something like it goes to, this is a nice formula. Very nice.
Adam, you should know this one. Can you read that at the bottom?
At the bottom, it is now, everything is pixelated, I have to say. But at the bottom is, a CERN.
Do
a CERN.
Remember?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Then. Yeah.
Because we met once, well, we met a few times in our lives, but we met once at Vox CERN. That was a few years ago. We visited the accelerator, the particle accelerator, and the CERN sells this T-shirt, which is quite a complex formula. That's why they have a QR code. So you scan the QR code and then explains you what it does. And I forgot about it. I just know the second formula. It's the Higgs boson, and the others, I forgot about it.
But okay, next time I should better prepare, you know?
You have a QR code in your T-shirt, and you scan it. And this way, you can go meet people and talk like you know the formulas, and people are pretty impressed about you. Yeah, you know.
This is cool. I could create a similar T-shirt with a fake formulas, you know, and see what happens then, you know? But what I was in CERN the very first time, and delivered a talk, of course, I think Java or something similar usually. And what I said is, you know, most projects are not so complicated as just create, read, update, delete. Who cares about, you know, you only have to implement simple logic like that. And after that, the scientists came to me and say, hey, look, we are at CERN here. We have actually a view algorithms as well, right? It's not like, I was like, hey, this is an exception from the rule. And then we had a nice conversation. In the cafeteria about architecture. So this was actually a nice experience the very first time.
Well, if you listeners, if you like technology, the CERN is a really amazing place. And you can even go with your kids because there's things for the kids, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not just talking about Voxt CERN, which is nice, but the CERN has plenty of things to discover on the weekend. You can go with your kids. And as a speaker of Vox CERN, we had the opportunity to visit the accelerator because they stop it every couple of years because you don't want to go in there. Well, it's up and running. And it was impressive. You know, it was really impressive. That's when you see real engineering, when you have this ring of 27 kilometers with particles reaching 99.99% speed of light, and all these captors, and as you say, all these algorithms gathering huge amount of data, etc. You look so small with your piece of code of Java. You know, it's like, wow.
But there's lots of Java there. They have a huge amount of Java code running there.
Yeah, yeah.
But 27 kilometers in a ring tunnel is actually a perfect opportunity, you know, to let your kids play, right? Because they can only go around, they can get lost. And if they 27 kilometers, they will spend, I don't know, 7 hours. So you can running, go to cafeteria, for 7 hours, and they will come back from other direction, right?
And they will come back naked, and they go to bed. Perfect.
Yeah, very good. So this was the advice, you know, parent advice. So how it works in real life. But the next problem is you forgot Java code a bit because you're a writer now, right? So you're writing a lot of books. So LangChain for J1s. You asked me before the show, could you just tell what the bytecode is? So I explained you briefly Java C and the class path. But now we are on the same level again. We both can compile Hello World main, and it will run, hopefully, with a little bit of Copilot, you know. Without this, it's hard, because what I was told is that the main method is too hard to learn in Java. This is why everyone uses different languages, because public static void main is impossible to remember. So, but with Copilot, you know, you can just say, write me main, and you get the Hello World out, yeah, right?
Yeah, and you can say, write it in Java. No, sorry, in C. Python.
Yeah, then you have a extreme agile polyglot, which is important. This would be actually cool, right? This would be a cool gag. This would be the 1st April. Use whatever, Copilot or ChatGPT or whatever, and say, write a true polyglot project with these languages, and try, you know, with GraalVM, for instance, and try, you know, to use as many languages as possible. Then we are in polyglot, you know. Then every developer feels in place. Everyone is included. No one knows what's going on, but it's very good for consultants.
But what you can do is that, and it's the... You know, AI is going so fast that there's, you know, we create patterns every couple of days, and those patterns get obsolete a few days later. But there's something quite interesting is, instead of, you know, when you do git commit and you put a random sentence, oh, I've tried to do that. What's actually interesting now is you commit the prompt that help you to generate the code. If you do that, you could actually take the commit history of a Java project, and you just change the very first commit that says, oh, and by the way, this has to be a Java project. And then you have all the commits which are business related, you know. I want to implement this. I want an API that returns that. I want this. I need this. So if your prompt is good enough, the code will be generated out of this prompt, and you commit this prompt. So when you read the commit history, you actually know what your piece of software does. So you just take that and shebang it in Java and another one in C and another one multi-languages.
I'm working with this similar ideas right now, but we should stop that because I wanted actually to promote your book today, so, and not talk about that. So
it's about AI.
AI, yeah. But you're still, what's your role right now? What you're working on in your professional life?
Mm-hmm. So yeah, hello, my name is Antonio. I'm a Java champion.
No, but you know, for
a living, what makes me, what gives me money? Well, I'm what we call a principal software engineer at Microsoft. I've been there for 3.5 years now. Mm-hmm. Like you, I was, you know, self-employed for nearly 20 years, 18 years. So now I'm a employee at Microsoft, and I also run DevOps France as a side project.
Ah, cool.
But what makes me living is being a principal software engineer at Microsoft.
Very good. And what's your focus, you know, right now?
Yeah. So when I arrived at Microsoft, this was 3.5 years ago. I actually had my very first interview in summer, so it's nearly 4 years, but the interview process took long. I had many interviews and blah, blah, blah. And I joined Microsoft, 3.5 years ago. And it was, you know what? You're a Java champion. You know a little bit of the cloud. Well, you're going to run Java on Azure. So, you know, helping customers to deploy their workload, their Java workload on Azure. Mm-hmm. They need different services, messaging, databases, you know, load balancing, mm-hmm. whatever. And a year and a half ago, they say, you know Java, you know the cloud, forget about it. Now everybody does AI. So that was quite interesting. That was an interesting move. Someone like me, I studied 30 years ago. I did software engineering,
This was punch algorithm. Cards, right? Back then.
Yeah, nearly. No, I remember. I did a bit of COBOL, you know. Uh-huh. I could earn a fortune now. I know a little bit of COBOL. So it was, you know, basically algorithms and software and bool algebra. And for me, AI was something either on the sci-fi side of it or the mathematical complex laboratories. So, you know, I did my entire career on writing algorithms. And for me, I would never thought I would touch AI on my career. So, Azure, Java, commodity. You know, knows that. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows that. Do something else. So it was quite an interesting shift. And the entire company, you know, there's a few thousand employees at Microsoft. Mm-hmm. And the entire company, like all the others, you know, Google, mm-hmm. Meta, whatever. We've been told now you have to learn something new. You have to learn new skills. And I'm sure that if you listen to this podcast, is because you love one thing about our job is we never stop learning. So when when my manager's chain told me now Java and Azure, it's okay, but now you have to go the AI, I went, wow. And internally, we had a lot of resources, a lot of blogs to read, articles, videos to watch. So we all ramped up quite quickly. And here I am 2 years after. And I do AI now. My customers, yes, they do Java. Yes, they are on the cloud. But now they want something more. Some of them still don't know what they can do with AI. And I think we are all in this space. But one thing they know is if they don't learn AI now, in 2 or 3 years' time, if they start learning AI, it might be too late. So even if...
Maybe not to learn AI, but how to use AI, right? So not to learn, so how to be effective with AI. This is...
Yeah, and all the vocabulary and the terminology, which changes a lot at the moment. You know, look at the pace. You know, 2 years ago, ChatGPT arrived. Now we are agents everywhere. We have so many models, so many platforms, so many design patterns that appear every day. Mm-hmm. So I think, my customers, even if some of them have a clear idea where to go, most of them just, you know, not totally clear. The one thing that is clear is we have to learn how to use this thing now. Because in 1 or 2 years, we will be efficient compared to our competitors. So, So that's what I do. So now I program in English.
Yeah, very good. Why I ask is because you mentioned one thing. Because I remember you work for Microsoft. I just wanted to know, but last time we talked was, I don't know, 1 year ago, something like this. And you mentioned patterns. They are changing. And you mentioned AI and Java. And I also spent some time with that. So I've 2 weeks ago, I delivered a course about LLMs and Java. But what I actually work right now is to thinking, you know, how to be effective with LLMs for Java. And now the question is, why Java? You mentioned patents, and what I noticed is the following. So as you know, we both, at the time you wrote, you know, the Glassfish book, I was spent some time with the patents, and both books were complementary. Actually, if I was a consultant back then, everyone asked whether I know you. You know Antonio? It's like, yeah, sure. Yeah, really? Yeah. And they asked me, do you know Aaron Gupta? I think, yeah, of course. We met all the time, and this was actually a nice time back then. And the patents are out there. My blog is out there. There are like 2,000 articles about patents. And, you know, there were all the GSRs and JCPs. They are public PDFs. They are a microprofile public PDF. And all the Quarkus tutorials are also public. What I noticed is that all the LLMs incredibly well know Java and all the patents. And at the same time, I mentioned it several times. What I sometimes did, people ask me, you know, as a new project, what I start with. It's like, okay, Quarkus is cool. They look at the Quarkus tutorial and they are confused because if you go, for instance, to JAX-RS, if you look up just the JAX-RS with Quarkus, right? How to write a RESTful resource. You will find maybe 5 ways how to do that. So they show you, know, the Jakarta way, the reactive way, and the REST easy way. And they ask, and people without our background, they don't care. They don't know. No, should I use the uni or multi with Quarkus? Should I use the JAX-RS or whatever? And AI is also confused, of course, because if you point to Quarkus, they will generate, you know, maybe one method which is reactive and the other one not. And what I notice is the standards, we both love. So for me, standards was actually the idea to have more vacations, because if you focus on standards, they move slower. And I ignored everything around. And what I have to tell you, it was the best strategy ever. Because right now, my clients come back to me and say, look, the old project, we look at the code. I remember we did this, no dependencies. Now we can migrate to Quarkus. And they are really happy. And all the attempts to do something different completely failed. So this is what I noticed, right? So so actually, 2 things, if you think about this, Java E and J2E never was legacy. Because you can run almost the same code on Quarkus without changes. This is actually cool what we did. So actually, you know, your role is completely different. But back then at the Glassfish time was actually the right thing to promote, because, you know, it was we focus on business and not, you know, the shiny frameworks which are no more available. What I even noticed that the reactive stream specification is almost, you know, deprecated. No one uses it anymore. And there was a huge buzz in my projects. Why I'm not reactive? And I completely ignored that, you know. And all the projects, my project, were fast enough. And now it works out of the box. So this was the good strategy. But now it comes. What I'm doing is I'm grounding LLMs to use the standards, just as. And what they generate with my patents, boundary control entity, not my. There are enough books. This is UML patents. This is the cool stories. Nothing is my. This was actually also a good hack, you know. Try to find standard and use it. And what happens right now, I get almost perfectly code, which looks like my code. So it means what I suspect is the next big wave is using patents to ground LLMs to make the code maintainable. And then even more what you said, you know, with the prompts, what you can do then it is, how to call it? AI is a probability machine, right? So, but if you point it to the standard direction, so the solution realm, or how to call it, is restricted. They will only find what they find in this realm. So your code would be more consistent, and your prompts can be even shorter. So you know what I do? I create rules for LLMs first, which are prompt independent. And in these rules is, you know, no dependencies, no external dependencies. If you find something in Java SE, but this is what I've wrote actually in my blogs. So what I did, I implemented MCP for my blog to pull the rules. And this is actually interesting finding. I didn't want to mention this because I know what happened. We will discuss about that the entire hour. But I think in the age of AI, standards become even more important, because now there's like common interface between agents and humans. Both understand that. And what I also noticed, if you use nice naming, boundary control entity with business names and domain names, the AI gets immediately out of context what you would like to do. So this is actually, you know, the art, the way how we structure the applications is very good. You know, sometimes I open my old project just to see what happens with AI, and they exactly know what happens. Oh, this is boundary control entity. This is this. They actually can understand what's going on because all the projects are structured the same way. So I think all the patterns and so forth will come again.
You know, it's interesting what you're saying, because we all worked for all these customers who, when you arrive, they have 252 pages of a Word document saying, these are the rules of the company. These are the vocabulary of the company. This is the way our project are structured and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Then you read the document or not, you forget the document or not. So then we add SONA rules. So here are the SONA rules that make sure that your code follows these, make sure blah, 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 blah. And so we have decades of this history.
Mm-hmm.
And AI, it's a new step on this history.
Yes.
Where you will write a prompt with, you should do this, you should do that. The naming convention is this, the formatting is that, blah, 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 blah. And you don't have to read the 252 pages. You don't have to run SONA rules. The LLM will produce the code you want following your rules, your patterns, your naming conventions. Yeah.
But what I actually wanted to say is, because all the work, boundary control entity, structure, and so forth, microprofile, was available publicly, all LLMs are pre-trained with it.
It's
the cool story is
vocabulary, yeah.
Yeah. Even without the rules, if you ask what boundary control entity, they will know and they will structure. And I was stunned. And I sometimes recognize articles from my blog, which is pretty cool, you know, because this was actually what I always wanted to achieve. Now I can say, okay, I can create a small, without any rules, and with the rules, I just refine stuff. Because there's a different code style for the cloud, a different code style on premise. So I have multiple styles to adjust a little bit, but the adjustments are minor. You know, you say, try to use record instead of that, Java records, right? So what I do is just, you know, make the code more perfect. And regarding the prompts, I write the prompts in readmes or Java docs. You know, you can use prompts as additional documentation for you. So what I'm talking about is, forget about LLMs. If you write clean code, no dependencies, because they confuse all the stuff, right? So if you have no dependencies, the entire context in Java, which were preached, you know, for years, and with all the already scanned documentation from MicroProfile, Java E, and so forth, with all the thing, you only have to tweak a little bit of rules and you are in. Because, you know, the entire Stack Overflow history is also in LLMs already. So, you know, this is like, and what I also had a nice chat is, Java is a type-safe language. So for LLMs, this is way easier to get the context than, let's say, Python. So I would say this is what I notice right now. I don't know why no one speaks about that. You are the first one who starts, you know, in this direction. Java has a great future, actually. So there is no need, actually. You know, if you have a legacy Java project, you could use LLM to transform it to something more modern. And what we did in the past, if you have a J2E project, even better, because all the documentation is out there and was already scanned by LLMs.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's funny because my daughter is 20 now. She's doing a mathematical degree. And
wow.
For this summer, she found a company where she's doing a bit of programming. It's not a main skill. She does mathematics, but it's difficult to find a job in mathematics. So for 3 months, she's doing mathematics and programming. And she's doing Java, actually. She's doing a bit of Python for all the data science.
Yeah, I will cut it out. Okay, let's go with Java.
And yeah, you know, she never done Java. She did a bit of Python, a bit of Go, a bit of C, I think, at school.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
No Java, and because they are allowed to use GitHub Copilot within this company, she just vibe codes Java. She can understand what's happening roughly.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't have to know the syntax. And but as you say, because Java is, you know, there's a specification, there's APIs, there's known APIs, all the backward compatibility that we have APIs for decades. Well, it actually runs and smoothly. There's no compilation error or stuff like that. So she doesn't know what she does 100%, but it works. It's only little things anyway.
Yeah.
And all that is vibe coded. And sometimes she pings me saying, hey, dad, what about this? What about that? But I'm quite amazed to see a new generation of developers who don't know much about algorithms, don't know much about what's happening, don't have a huge architectural culture. But that's we don't ask them to have all this knowledge. We ask them small tasks that they can achieve thanks to LLMs. And yeah, you know, they will learn anyway.
So yes, but it will work in the case of your daughter because she already asked questions, right? So I think now if you are a junior developer and you are curious, golden times, because you can learn very quickly. Because what you can do, but you have to be disciplined, I think. So if you let vibe code something, you should ask questions, you know, why you did it. And LLM will explain. If you don't understand, you have to copy it and ask different LLM. If you work with Claude, you know, go to ChatGPT, but you learn very quickly. But there are, no, how to call it, like, you know, startup guys, I don't know, they would like to vibe code something without any knowledge. You can completely forget it because, you know, after three prompts, they will generate so much code, no one will understand what's going on. So I think if you are junior, golden times, but try to understand every line what is generated, if you have time, right? So if you would like to learn. And then if you don't understand what's going on, ask what happens, you know, until you understand. And you can run, you can learn 10 times faster than we did because we had, you know, to read a book or article, and now you get the answer right away. So don't be lazy, ask questions, and then it's golden, right?
That's totally true. And plus, you know, even if she's doing a 3-month project and she spends 2 days at home working remote, LLMs are fantastic for that. As you say, you can ask as many questions as you want. They will always answer. And if you are remote, you don't have any colleague, just ask the LLM. And it's true, but it's true with everything. You know, I play guitar and I start playing guitar 40 years ago. 40 years ago, there was no internet. There was nothing. So I
you're not that old. Are you already fake AI whom you are speaking? You know, you look like 20 years old. Everything, you know, was filters or whatever, right? So
no, but learning guitar at the time was buying books, was having CDs, playing chords, etc., etc. Now, when you see all the guitar classes on YouTube, I wish I had that. You can play them again and again and again. It's very visual, etc., etc. Same for the LLM. As you say, we started coding. There was no internet. We had to read books and articles. And today, you have a brilliant coding partner that is always available, always 24/7, and can answer all your questions. So I agree with you. To do this job, curiosity is king. Yeah. You have to, you need to love to new few things and learn and
critical thinking. Right? Always ask: Is it right? Right? And people say LLMs hallucinate, but you know most of my consultants. Colleagues also hallucinated back then, right? So what they wanted to build was in, like, you know, distributed caches, and I don't know, we distribute everything because it will be more, you know, scalable, which nothing was true, actually.
Oh, and remember all these layers of abstraction.
Layers, of course, we have to decouple because one day someone, this
was hallucination. We will change the database and we'll change the messaging system and we will change everything. Yeah.
In one project that you wanted to, it's like maybe one day we will, you know, replace Oracle with DB2.
Yeah.
And I know the
perfect
place.
Hallucination.
Still, there are now 20 layers and the old database still.
Yeah. You know? Because what costs you money is not changing the very thin layer of the database. Yeah. It's dumping DB2 or Oracle.
This was hallucination, you know. And all
totally hallucinations. Yep. Architecture. You know, we talk about the ivory tower architect. Well, I will call them now hallucinating architects.
Yeah, the hallucinators.
Totally hallucinated for decades.
Yeah, yeah. And the entire, you know, history of Java was at the beginning was too slow, so there was attempts to call C. Then I remember a period when they say Java is a system language, it's too fast, and therefore we have to use something nicer like Groovy or whatever. And now is Java very fast, and no one talks about that, because Python is now in. But if I mention that Python is 35 times slower than Java, everyone is surprised. Really, show me this, and I show you. Then you know. So I think if this Java will be the new Java 25 I'm waiting for, or even Java 21, 24, is amazing what it can do, right? Even FFM, you can call functions and so forth. Okay, cool. I will re-invite you back because I have more to tell, you know, with the LLMs, and maybe it will interest you know how to structure projects in Java and something like this. We can have a session about that. But LangChain4j is very interesting, and you've wrote one book twice already, right? The second edition. So it's
second edition.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wrote the first book, LangChain4j, back in October 2024. Mm-hmm. LangChain4j was in version 0.35. Mm-hmm. And since then, 1.0 has hit, deprecating a lot of APIs. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I wrote, I updated my LangChain4j book. Mm-hmm. So the second edition was out a couple of months ago with the brand new APIs and also a few extra chapters. Mm-hmm. So what... When I started...
So I had the author of LangChain4j on this podcast already. So now he works for Quarkus. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And we had a deep conversation about LangChain4j, but maybe from your perspective, what is LangChain4j? So short intro.
So LangChain4j is a SDK to talk to LLMs. You know, there's so many LLMs out there. They all have an API. You can use curl. You can use Jaxrs. You know, it's just an HTTP GET on an endpoint, passing a few parameters to an LLM, and it will spit you out text. And even if some LLMs now providers try to standardize around the OpenAI API, they all have different APIs. So you try to have a curl that asks an LLM to say hello. The curl invocation will be different. So then comes an SDK. You know, same thing. Why are we doing Jaxrs? Well, we could do being, you know, curls or HTTP calls. SDK is way simpler. So that's exactly what LangChain4j is. Mm-hmm. LangChain4j arrived. Well, there was nothing in Java at the moment. At the time. So either you would do Python, and I admit I had to do Python at the beginning when I was playing with LLMs, trying to discover. The Python world around LLMs is huge. They have fantastic tools that we will never have. We will never have such tools because they are complex to design, create, and why bother? You know, it's a tool. It's a tool. It's written in Python. Good. But for our business projects, to interact with an LLM, you can't say, oh, this is my huge monolith or microservices written in Java. Let's invoke Python now. So that's when LangChain4j came along saying, hey, what about having an SDK in Java, not in Python or something else? So LangChain4j is with three lines of code. You simulate a curl invocation, a bit like, you know, with one line of code and one annotation with Jaxrs, you simulate an HTTP call. So same thing.
Like JDBC for LLMs, right?
Exactly. Because with LangChain4j, you can swap a GPT-4 model with a Gemini-4 model, with a Claude model, just by changing one or two lines of code instead of changing, you know, a complete HTTP call. So there's that. There's, first of all, when I discovered LangChain4j, it was for me an SDK to invoke LLMs in a very friendly way within my language. So remember, my customers do Java and they want to, you know, have access to LLMs, what do they do? Well, with LangChain4j now, they have an SDK, and it's very, very easy. And then I think the Java community realized that finally there was something. Spring AI wasn't around already at the time. And there was, you know, I remember it was 2.5 years ago at DevOps Belgium when Dimitro and Liz did they talk on LangChain4j. And everybody was, wow, there's something, you know, in the Java space. Because if you were a Java developer and you wanted to do AI, people will say, hey, do Python. So I think that's why LangChain4j was there first, slightly before Spring AI. And the entire Java community embraced LangChain4j going, hey, you know, I can use AI with Java. I was one of them. So I was doing some Python and I started to do some Java going, oh, yes, cool. And so internally, I was doing more and more LangChain4j because I work for Microsoft. We have Azure. We have plenty of models. We have Azure Search. We have, you know, embeddings and so on. I started to contribute also on the Azure support for LangChain4j. So there's now a few Microsofties that work, you know, contribute on LangChain4j, mostly on the Azure side of it.
This I wanted to ask you. It means this is what I wanted to ask you. So it means Microsoft contributes actively to LangChain4j, right?
Well, it's difficult to say Microsoft. You know, it's like
okay.
Google, Guillaume Laforge contributes a lot on Gemini. So Antonio, Julien Dubois, and a few others are Microsoft employees, but I would not say I'm officially, you know, Microsoft didn't officially ask me to do so. It's just on my spare time. And Microsoft, like all the big companies, contribute to many, many open source projects. And if there's something missing, you know, the idea is to have Azure sort of supporting, you know, having better support on Azure on the Java side of it. We have .NET frameworks that do that. We have Python because we have a lot of Python developers within Microsoft. So it's not officially, but yeah, you know, every now and then we talk to our managers saying, hey, you know, we've improved the Azure Search support on LangChain4j or Azure AI Foundry now that we have. So
I know what I mean, but I think it will never officially, except, you know, Satya Nadella says, okay, now go and implement, you know, LangChain4j. But this is more like you have to make Java and AI successful for Microsoft and do whatever it has to be done. And if you see, okay, there is something which, if you change something in LangChain4j to be better, better integrated with Azure, then you can do a view commits if you ask the managers, and this is how it works. But
basically, we have Microsoft, like many other companies, I suppose, but we are very customer focused. You know, I work for my customers, and if my customers can't use Azure in their Java product because there's a Java API missing, well, we have to implement it. We have to make our customers happy, basically. So that's why I started to use LangChain4j, very early versions, start to contribute. I start also to write internal articles about LangChain4j, external articles too. And guess what? You know, one day I was at a workshop with Dimitro and Liz, and it was a LangChain4j workshop, a one-day workshop. And then we had dinner at a restaurant, the three of us, with Dimitris also from Red Hat. And I said, look, guys, I have this idea. You know, I've already written a few books. I have all this tool chain in ASCII Doctor. So I have thousands of files with the definition of Java, the definition of this, the definition of that. I know how to structure appendixes quickly. I know to create a book you know, a technical structure. I can, you know, I know how to do that. And because internally I've been writing more and more content on LangChain4j, I want to write a book on LangChain4j. And they went, wow, brilliant, because we were thinking about that, but we don't have time. And so it was quite interesting because this book, it's the eighth book I've written. I've written on Java E6, 7, Quarkus, Bin Validation, JPA, blah, blah, blah. But this is the first book I've written with the help of an LLM. So it's, there's parts of my book, like, you know, the introduction, the summary, all these parts that are boring. You just wrote 12 pages and you need to summarize that into paragraphs. God, now we have an LLM. So it's quite interesting because I also learn how to prompt, not to generate code, but to generate a book about, this is my style of writing. Look at this sentence. I tend to use these verbs, blah, blah, blah. This is the summary I wrote in my previous books. Well, now guess what? Here is chapter two, and create a summary based on this chapter two and the style of writing and all the instructions that I've given you. So I don't know how much of my book is written by an LLM. I don't know, 10, 12%, 15%, I don't know. But it's true that it also helped me because when you write a book, what I really like is structure my thoughts, introduce technology A, introduce technology B, introduce technology, you know, I quite like that. So you spend a lot of time structuring your thoughts. Then I write code. I like to write code. So I write LangChain4j code. Thanks to ASCII-Doc, I can include bits of code in my book. And there's parts missing.
And how you wrote your books? So you started with code and then the text, or text and code then?
So I started with the table of content.
But usually, all the books, this is what you usually did?
Uh-huh. I always start with the table of content. I always start with the table of content, and I go to level two or three because it helps me to structure my thoughts. And then I put the code.
Yeah. For me, almost the same.
Because I have my table of contents with chapter level one, chapter level two, three. Then I put my code. So that's quite nice because I'm on my IDE, I write code. And on my ASCII-Doc, I point out the code, blah, blah, blah. And when I write code, because it was LangChain4j, I didn't know much about LangChain4j. So I also discovered, and I would put comments on my code. So here is the trick. When you embed a bit of Java code within your LangChain4j, I would also embed the comments. So here I am. Now I have a PDF of 100 pages long with the structure that I want, code here and there, bits of sentences that I've started but not finished, and the code is commented. So now I can ask an LLM about, help me to finish my sentence. Because even if the LLM didn't know LangChain4j, it was too new, there was my code comments written in English so the LLM could understand. Some of my sentences that I would put here and there, and then my LLM could help me. And remember, I write in ASCII-Doc, so I'm inside my IDE writing in English and writing in Java, and I have GitHub Copilot just there helping me to finish my sentence and GitHub Copilot chat, et cetera, et cetera. So it was a book about AI using some of AI. I didn't use Copilot to generate code because, again, LangChain4j is too new. Copilot didn't know about it at the time. So I did not use AI to write code. I use AI to help me write bits and pieces of my book.
That's interesting. I wrote my last book way before arrival of LLMs, but the approach was similar. So I didn't start it with the agenda, but because I clearly knew how it looks like, because for me, the scope was, you know, this Jakarta or Java E was somehow best practices were clear how you structure, you know, from presentation to backend. So this was clear. But what usually happened, I spent time in projects. So I implemented a few projects with the code. And then I said, okay, this is fine. And now for the book, I wrote an example, but now from scratch. Exactly as you did, without LLMs. And so I, you know, I started, you know, write a line and thought why I did it. So what was the idea behind and described in the book, the next line and so. And this was lots of fun. But the entire book was always code driven, actually, where I implemented something from scratch, what I did before. But then I was forced to think about this. And the cool story is, if you do this, you come up with new ideas, which will never come up, you know, in your project life, because in project is highly optimized, you know, go as fast, as simple, no risk. But then you can explore new ideas, which was also great. So it's good to hear that you had a similar approach, because I always wanted to ask other authors how they wrote the books, you know. This was
Code first. Structure, yeah. Then code, then fill the sentences. And if you think about it, you know, before LLMs, writing a book, you know, the writing part was important. You know, oh, you are a writer. I'll invite you to speak to this podcast because you are a famous author. You are a writer. But if you think about it, you know, filling gaps with English became the less interesting thing. You know, what I really love is structure my thoughts. So table of content. I spent weeks, you know, imagining, refactoring my table of content. Then writing code, that is fun. For a new project like LangChain4j, I was discovering the APIs while I was coding, you know, investigating, trying new parameters, see how it works. You know, that was fun.
Yeah.
Then when you have the structure, when you have the code within the structure, filling empty blocks with bits of English, that's when you realize that was not the most attractive part of writing a book. Yeah. And that wasn't the most intellectually appealing part either, because you have an empty space that you must fill for somebody to read and understand what's going on. That's not appealing. You go, man, the code is there. You know, just read the bloody code.
Yeah.
So you realize that you know, actually writing a technical book, we are talking about writing technical book, not romance book or literature. Filling the gaps with
I think a romance sentences. Book has to also be, you know, highly structured, I think. Otherwise, if you swap the order, you know, it'd be no more appealing, I guess. Yeah.
Adam, romance has to be structured. I keep this sentence.
Yeah. We are experts in all areas, you know.
Well,
You have to ask it, you know, the ChatGPT about that. Does romance has to be structured? And what do you get? The answer will be an interesting one. So
I think we are part of the old generation anyway. We're not too big. We're not big on social medias. We're not big on AIs. But when you look at the young generation using AI as a psychologist or AI as a therapist or AI as a romance advisor.
Yeah.
The AI is already used by that, not by us, but by other people, I'm sure.
Very good. LangChain4j, you said this is the SDK to LLMs, but this is more than that, right? So what it also helps you, you know, chunks your documents and stuff like that for the regs and all the not that shiny stuff, you know, because my trajectory was different. So if API was available, I immediately applied for Anthropic. It was later in Europe, but I got one of the first the Anthropic API access. And then I wrote Java, JDK 21, actually. 21? I don't know, but with a HTTP client in Java, right? The access. And it worked, and this was good because then I used the same on AWS Bedrock, and it was a little bit different. So it was good for me, you know, to see, you know, the a little bit the differences. And then keeping actually using my own SDK to see the full power of the APIs because, okay, which parameters are available. And LangChain4j was an abstraction, and to talk to LLM was not that interesting for me. But embedding, you know, to have the embedding stores, great, with LangChain4j. This is a huge help. Or, you know, having the conversation memory, which paired with Quarkus, huge help. Or, you know, be able to chunk, to create embeddings from a larger document and just play with the parameters. So I could do it by myself, but I knew how what to do, but it was boring. It's like, this is better, you know, to do LangChain4j for me. And I would say LangChain4j is great, but LangChain4j paired with Quarkus is really magic because I don't know whether you also covered this in your book. I didn't read your I only bought your book, I have to admit, but never read it. But Will, the problem was, you know, too busy. But the interesting part is we had in Quarkus and especially MicroProfile scopes, request scoped, application scope, and session scope. And interestingly, these scopes are perfect for LLMs, right? Because if you talk to an LLM, you also need a kind of a session. And even conversation scope, actually, you could a conversation scope even better. We had actually a chat about it already.
Yes, we talked about conversation scope.
Yeah, and if we if your application is in the middle and with LangChain4j, and you can actually consider an LLM as a kind of a microservice, and then just talk to it. And then we get hexagonal architecture almost because the first time in the history, because we are in the middle and we have embedding store, we have LLM one, maybe embedding model, and we have multiple actually kinds of LLMs. But we don't be too coupled to this because LLM maybe less so, but embedding store is likely then we can swap it, you know, because something as is scalable does not like a huge difference. LLMs a little bit more careful because the prompts sometimes have to be targeted to one LLM to get the best results, right?
But LangChain4j, you know, if you are in front of Cloud or GitHub Copilot, you don't realize, but as you were saying, you have memory, you have context, so you can add PDFs to a project, to a context, say, hey, this is the data of my company. Take all these PDFs, chunk them, do whatever you want. Now let me chat. You can have several chats. So that means you have context, you have memory, but you have independent memory. Now you can very easily integrate tools. All that in front of this UI. And basically LangChain4j lets you to do all that, but not using UI, using Java code, because as you said, you have all the RAG thing that is looked after. So you can tell your customers, give me all your PDFs, and you can process those PDFs. Then you have to manage the history that can be transient, or you can persist it in storage too. It can be multi-tenant. So for a customer, you can have several history going on, chats, and you store that in storage, not in memory. And now with LangChain4j, the last version, from version one, I think, you have an MCP client. So within LangChain4j, within your Java code, you can invoke MCP servers. So basically, if you are comfortable in front of your cloud, having tools, having memory, context, putting PDFs on your in your context, and so on, you can do all that with LangChain4j within your Java project. So that's quite interesting. You can have the same richness, the same features that you have in front of Cloud UI or GitHub Copilot UI, but in your Java code.
You mentioned MCP Model Context Protocol, which becomes another standard, was actually initiated by Anthropic last year in November, but is now common standard by everyone. So Microsoft officially supports, everyone supports MCP, Model Context Protocol. And my feeling is a bit that MCP may steal some use cases from REC, right? Because this REC, retrieval augmented generation, is like if you have a prompt, you get to the store and you get, you know, the you enrich the context of the LLM with the facts. But with MCP, you get the same. So if you I would say MCP may standardize a REC a little bit more, right?
Yeah, but not only, because MCP, you can use tools to do something also. You know, yeah. I created this.
But with resources, you get, you know, resources, you get your feed from your company. So with resources, yeah. It's easier, for instance, to implement a REC, because you get a resource which gives you exactly this information you would like to do, and you only need access to a database, to Postgres, for instance.
Yeah.
And with tools, is more. You are right. So it's more powerful than REC, but it could replace parts of the REC use cases, actually.
That's true, because in the MCP protocol, we have tools, and we talk a lot about tools. But as you say, we have resources and prompts.
Exactly.
And it's funny, because you started talking about the Jakarta EE, JCP, and standardization and specification. We were both in there. And, you know, a specification will take years. Mm-hmm. People will vote and people will argue, and it will take years. And look at MCP. It only took a few months, and everybody was behind that. Microsoft is now involved, because there's no authentication on MCP. You know, you can ask MCP whatever.
But if you read the standard, I have to say, the MCP, it is like, you cannot compare it with Java E, right? This is so ambiguous. And actually, the example is the schema. And I say, where is the schema? There is no schema. It's the example. So, okay, then I know roughly what to do, right? But it works. But my point is not that the Java E standards is way to go. They are out there, you know? This is the cool story. They are out there and still valid. And you can use them as a context for your LLM and generate code targeted to Quarkus. And what do you get? The fastest runtime with code which everyone understands, you know, from your grandfather to young generation. And the code is actually simple. Yeah? In most projects, you only have to know add inject, and you are basically done, right? So this is this is actually, if you are reasonable, this is how Java E looks like. And from time to time, it was DevOps or WJAX in Munich. So after that, I show some Quarkus with best practices. This came to me, he's like, what is it? This is so simple and fast. What is it? It's like, yeah, this is a Quarkus. This is what I do for years. You know, this is like the Jakarta E code. And they were stunned how nice Java actually is these days.
And I didn't talk about it in my book because I didn't have time. And it was also quite new. But the LangChain4j support in Quarkus is amazing.
Exactly.
One annotation and you're in.
Covered Quarkus at all?
No, in the book, no. No.
So then maybe for the listeners, what is the added value? If you use LangChain4j with Quarkus, what do you, for instance, do? Use, for instance, the Quarkus configuration for the key management, right? So what you can just say, okay, this is, and you can have multiple models and configure this in the property file and annotation, and it will pick the right one. So with Quarkus, you can inject an interface with a string as parameter. This is your prompt, and you get the answer. And indirectly, your book is integrated. You know, whatever you learned in your book, you know how to configure and use LangChain4j, and then you can inject these parts in Quarkus, which makes it very simple. I mean, it boils down to using one annotation, and you can inject, you know, for instance, the chat, right? Or chat memory. So I would say, like, the Quarkus is more like syntactic sugar on top of LangChain4j, right? With the DSL. Plus, yeah. You get the multi-tenant behavior that every user's chat is independent. Because if you do it by yourself, and if you're a singleton, you have the same problem that we had, you know, 30 years ago. We have a servlet, and in the session are all users of your website. So the first invention was, you know, you have J session ID to have something like the J session ID or HTTP session or a cookie you need for prompts, because you have one service for multiple users, right?
And also because they've created extensions out of LangChain4j, it's super optimized for Quarkus. So optimized at build time, mm-hmm. and you can compile it with Graal VM and have binaries, which mm-hmm. if you think about it, there's also there's something quite unknown in the Quarkus world is you can create CLIs. You know, they have the Pico CLI integration.
And batch processing, right? And not only this, batch processing. You can have a CLI and main methods, so you can have serverless LLMs, right? They do something and goes to sleep for batch processing, which could be actually very interesting for validations and stuff like that, right?
And you could have, you know, imagine a Quarkus with the CLI extension and LangChain4j extension, and you compile it in a binary. So here, you know, here you are on your Linux or your Mac, and you have a command line that interact with your LLMs. It's very powerful. Yeah, I didn't cover the LangChain4j support on Quarkus. Next edition, you'll have to invite me again. But very good what they've done, and super optimized for Quarkus build time, native compilation, and so on. Yeah.
What is your, you know, the agenda of your book? So the rough agenda. So if someone buys your book, so what you covered? Because, you know, these calling LLMs is okay. So this is perfect for conferences. You have one line and it works, right? But what you covered? Which areas?
My books, you know, as I said, I've written 8 books now, and they are all structured the same. You know, they have. So the first section is really understanding LangChain4j. So the first section, you understand, you know, what is a model, what is a prompt, what is a token, what, you know, stuff like that. And then you have a getting started. Now that you know the terminology, here is the Java code to do a richer Hello World kind of thing, to make sure you have your OpenAI key, to make sure you have all the LangChain dependencies and so on. So that's the section one. If you manage to go through the section one, the book will work because now you have the environment and you know the terminology. So then you have a section about AI models, as you say, how to access a model, how to have a conversation with the model, how to enrich your model with tools and MCP. So section two is all about models. Then section three is all about RAG. How do you process mm-hmm. documents with LangChain4j? How do you handle embeddings with LangChain4j? How you take a document in input, chunk it, create embeddings, store them in embedding stores. So there's one section only on RAG. And then there's a section where LangChain4j simplifies AI a lot with AI services. So AI services, easy RAG with AI services. So making things simpler. Then one day you'll have the integration section, LangChain4j with Quarkus, LangChain4j with Spring Boot, LangChain4j with Micronaut.
And embedding stores? You covered embedding stores?
Yeah. Okay. Embedding stores with the embeddings. And then wrapping up, I like to wrap up my book. Now that you know everything, let's take a much more complex use case and implement it. So you implement a document ingestion, taking the PDFs, chunking them, putting, you know, the embeddings on a store, and then invoking models, you know, a proper RAG example. So the book goes, from getting started to putting all together, and in the middle, models, RAGs, tools, MCP client, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So it's around, without the appendix, it's around 200 and something pages. And with the appendix, it's 300. But it's 200 pages long. With the code that is embedded on the documentation, open source on GitHub. So the code that you read actually compiles, which is nice.
Very good. What I did recently, maybe you are interested. So ZMCP, Zero Dependencies Model Context Protocol in Java is a server. It uses SDDIO, and you can write your own extensions with service loader. So there's no external dependencies. And why I did it, I did for my purposes. I can, for instance, right now with that, search my podcast, what were the recent guests or whatever. But this is not open. What I have is link checker. I have file access resources. You can access your resources and tools. And also fun, code executor. You can write, for instance, write a formula. And what it does, it uses JShell, executes Java code. It comes back, which is pretty cool, actually. And of course, you can have it's a secure version with GraalVM and Espresso, because then it is completely, is like security manager, cannot break out. But this was fun. Look at this. Maybe you like the code. And regarding GraalVM and future, so I have to invite you back very soon. TornadoVM.
TornadoVM rings a bell, but yeah.
So there was a recent podcast. You will have to listen to view of the podcast. So what they are able to do is they can read Java code, and if you put some annotations, they can execute the Java code on GPUs. Oh. Llama 3 Java from Alfonso, he was on DevOps. So the idea was he was on my podcast and we had a chat how it works behind the scene, and Alfonso used SIMD from Java. SIMD is this simple single instruction multiple data. So, and it was already crazy fast. It's a preview in Java 21. And the TornadoVM folks look at that and say, okay, maybe we try to optimize. And they tried to optimize, but it couldn't. It was just 10% faster. And they say, why? And they took a look how it works is, and because what they did is they interacted too often with the GPU. So, you know, they called the GPU, they got the answer back and so forth. And a few weeks ago, they re-implemented TornadoVM. So the new release is able to put the data once to the GPU, had in GPU the calls from kernel to kernel in the GPU without leaving the GPU. And now it is 6 to 10 times faster than the Alfonso. It means in Alfonso case, on my machine, what I did on DevOps was like 10 tokens per second. Now they can achieve 100 tokens per second on NVIDIA card. And Metal support will come this winter. They promised me indirectly. So I say, for Christmas would be cool. Say, maybe, right? So I have to listen to the episode. But what it means for me, you mentioned GraalVM. What they also do right now, they try to optimize GraalVM for LLM as well. So what I think, what is even more interesting, having, you know, Quarkus with LangChain4j, and a local model, everything compiled to one big native thing. And then is this for enterprise even more important, because you can have a local inference for stuff like, you know, parameter checks and stuff like that, for instance. And what I also think that the future will be smaller models with a specific purpose. You don't need, you know, Claude, which knows about, you know, your history and all your 8 books, if you only would like, you know, to check whether the address is correct, for instance. Mm. So there will be distilled models and models with specific capabilities. And so this is why GraalVM and Quarkus are very interesting.
There's one thing in Azure AI Foundry. Sorry, I talk about Azure.
No, just go for it, because this is what lots of enterprise companies are using Azure. And this is my listeners are using Microsoft Azure as well. So this is actually, yeah.
And there's one thing that I maybe available in other providers, I don't know, but what we call a model router. And it's very interesting. You go to Azure Foundry, you have thousands of models. Pick up model router and prompt. And basically the model router would go, oh, for this kind of prompt, I don't need a GPT-4.5. I don't need a Claude. I don't need Grok or whatever. I can answer this question with a O1 mini. And it's very interesting because, as you say, we come from this ChatGPT, you know, Claude, all these big, big things. But now more and more we are going to agents. We want an agent to do one thing specifically and very well. Well, maybe this agent just only knows how to pass XML, and this agent only wants to you know, speak in French, not in
like a microservice languages. Even, right? So the microservice architecture for agents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's when SLM small models become interesting. Because at the moment, everybody goes, which one to pick? Oh, I pick the big one. Of course, you'll get an answer back, but then you'll have to pay for that at the end of the
month. And not only paying, the problem is throttling.
Yeah.
The big models, you get throttled everywhere. If you use, you know, the less appealing models, it is more stable and fast.
And now what I do is each time I have an idea or whatever, I go to this model router and I prompt, you know, it can be small prompt or huge prompt, and the model goes, I would use a 04 mini or I would use a 01 Monex or whatever. So
this is part of the Azure AI, right?
Yeah. Azure AI Foundry. Yep.
Yeah. And
I think it's still in preview, model router. And it basically will route your prompt to what he thinks is the best model.
Yeah. AWS Bedrock with similar functionality. And some of my clients are using Azure AI and others AWS Bedrock. But what they are also using that is, I think in Azure AI is the same, because the data won't leave the network, right? From Azure, and Azure won't train the models with the prompts. This is the case on AWS Bedrock. So this is why my clients have contracts with Microsoft or AWS, and they are not allowed to talk directly to OpenAI or Anthropic, because then there's no such relation. So I would say in most enterprise projects, they either use Azure AI, this was, or AWS Bedrock. This is the two possibilities. Sometimes they have an own gateway, which routes between both. This is also, they have like, you know, how to call it, an API gateway, which connects AWS Bedrock and Azure AI at the same time, right? Mm. What's also new is interesting, Azure AI also supports Claude, right? Anthropic.
No, not Claude, but we have Grok, we have
not Mistral. Claude? You're sure?
God, no, I don't
I think. Thought recently, okay, interesting.
Now I'm looking for, because...
And Mistral is big thing, because Mistral is French, which is already good in Europe, and this is open source. So I think Mistral will be big for European companies, I guess.
Yeah, I'm having a look at the models. Claude is not there.
Okay, I thought.
So DeepSeek, you know, all these models, and Mistral. Yeah,
Okay. Mistral was there. Yeah.
Well, Mistral is, you know, French, but they had a... They had pocket money in France, and then they needed more money, and they had to go to the US, like a lot of European companies, unfortunately.
But this doesn't matter. This is what appeals to managers. And, you know, if this is the decision, if I'm allowed only to use Mistral in European project, what I do, you know, I just use that. And this is what Langchain4j shines, because I can swap the models behind the scenes, right?
Exactly.
Very good. Yeah. Antonio, what's the name of the book, and how to buy your book?
Understanding Langchain4j. And you can buy it actually on Amazon. You go to Amazon. I have a Kindle version. And the good thing with Amazon is they can print books. So if you want one book, they will print one book. That's good. I actually, each time I publish a book, I buy my own book on paper book so I can give it to my kids so they can draw on it. And so Kindle...
So your daughter... draws on your books?
my oldest now looks at me going, yeah. The two young ones are still impressed. Wow, Dad wrote a book. Yeah, the old one is not impressed anymore. It's difficult to impress a 20-year-old kid. So you can go to Amazon, Kindle version, paper version. But you can also go on my platform, Teachable. And so you can have the PDF and the EPUB version.
This is how I bought your first book from Teachable.
Yeah. And the Teachable, you know, it's not for the huge millions of dollars that I make out of selling my book. But the only good thing, if you buy on Teachable, you get a PDF and you get an EPUB that you can send to your Kindle. But the good thing is when I update my book like now, second edition, I gave 80% discount to the people who bought my first edition.
Cool. Mm-hmm.
Which I can't do on Amazon. You know, on Amazon, unfortunately, you push a file and that's it. And that's the end of it. So if I push a second edition, well, there's nothing much I can do. So if you want paper, go to Amazon. If you want EPUB or PDF, go to my Teachable platform. And when the third edition comes with a Quarkus support, you'll get an 80 or 90% discount.
So what you're saying is that the Ferrari behind you is not from the book, from Teachable.
I live in Paris. I cycle everywhere. I never had a car in my life.
You can also have a Colnago, you know, Colnago bike for 20,000 euros again.
I have a Dutch bike.
Very good. Yeah, very good. It's stable. It's Dutch bike is like J2E, right? Stable and no dependencies.
A bit heavy, but stable. I have
very good.
Gazelle, typical Dutch bike.
Very good.
Black, 25 kilos, perfect. It's 20 years old, never crashes. They love Dutch bikes.
Thank you a lot. And where people can find you on the internet, maybe. You know, reference to social, we forgot almost. Twitter, LinkedIn, or whatever.
Well, you know, I'm still on Twitter because I've created this account many, many decades ago. But I don't publish there anymore for different reasons. So I'm on Blue Sky and LinkedIn. Yeah, okay. You will not find me on TikTok, Instagram, Facebook. Yeah. I forgot about them. But LinkedIn is where I usually publish my things. And Blue Sky when I, you know, need the community help or some things like that. I'm not a heavy consumer of social medias, but LinkedIn is nice.
Okay. Thank you. And see you next time.
Thank you, Adam. Thanks for having me. And yeah, who knows, for the third edition with a Micronaut Quarkus and Spring Boot integration with Langchain4j.
Perfect. Thank you a lot.
Bye.